night. It takes a long pull from the smoke. There's a tumbleweed tumbling its way on down throughout Alanto.
Hey everybody, welcome to the 440 Guitar Podcast. I'm your host, Ro Powell. Thank you so much for tuning up. Be sure to catch the podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and anchor.fm/440. You can also follow the podcast on Instagram at the 440 Guitar Podcast to get updates on the episodes coming out. And also, if you have a question, if you know of an artist that I should speak to or whatnot, feel free to either send me a direct message on Instagram. You can send me an email at the440podcast@gmail.com, or you can even leave me a voicemail at the anchor.fm/440. Had the luxury of speaking to a really great artist that he left me a voicemail on there. So feel free to do that if you'd like to do so. And today I'm very excited to speak with this artist here. And just to give you a little bit of an idea of the style of this artist, I'm reading a quote here. It says here that this collection of genre-bending gonzo country was birthed at the DOB Sound in Santa Fe Springs, California. This album that we're going to be talking about here delivers a fresh band of outlaw country that cuts through the static and brings the lucky listener along for one hell of a midnight ride, which is what I endured when I checked it out a little bit. But the 440 Guitar Podcast is excited to have Andrew Browning here on the show. How you doing, Andrew?
Hey, I'm good. Thanks for having me, man.
Of course. Most definitely. So what's been going on for you this week? Have you had some shows that you've been playing through, or what's been happening musically for you?
So this week there hasn't been anything. For the last few weeks we had a bunch of shows, and we just finished our last one at the Maui Sugar Mill Saloon out in Tarzana, California. And then we've got some dates coming up in Long Beach in a few weeks, and one at the Silver Lake Lounge. So a lot of stuff happening in Southern California. I'm taking this week off because I actually have an Ironman I have to do in Arizona. So,
oh wow.
Yeah. So this week I'm taking off, but all the rest of the weeks, yeah, we're packed up pretty well.
An Ironman, for those who are not familiar, what is that exactly?
That's a long course triathlon.
Oh,
and,
oh man.
You know, one of the way that the reason I got into that, I mean, you know, I try to stay fit, but, you know, I feel like it's one of those things that I can really, you know, when I'm on stage, right, I expend a lot of energy, right? And that has really made my live stamina a lot better, right? Doing a lot of this endurance sport. So it really does feed into my live musical performance.
I think that's really smart, you know, because I definitely... It makes a lot of sense. I agree with you on that, especially because, you know, a lot of performers, you know, we're all vast at ages, but when it comes to your energy performing live, giving that to the audience, it takes a lot out of you. So being able to try to be as fit as possible and then doing that before the holidays, when all that terrible food that you'll be eating, you know, or try to avoid as much as possible, something like that definitely makes sense. And I know those Ironmans, those are pretty strenuous courses, aren't they?
They are, and a lot of training leading up to that. So as the holidays come up after this weekend, I'll be looking forward to fattening up and getting into some poor shape before I get back into good shape again.
Yeah, well, I tip my hat off to you. Yeah, that's definitely not a, you know, that's a pretty heck of a feat there. So very cool. So on the 440 Guitar Podcast, really big on origin stories. You know, like to talk about how people got to where they are today. So one of the first questions I usually always like to ask my folks, tell me about your first memory of music.
So this is a little embarrassing, I think. My parents had, when I was a kid, this old hi-fi system, right? It was a Fisher hi-fi system. I think it even was like vacuum tube powered, you know, had that really good sound. And it had like a turntable, and it had an 8-track tape player. And even at that time, when I was a kid, 8-track tape players were like out of fashion, but my parents didn't really listen to music. I mean, they listened to it some, but it wasn't their thing. My parents were painters, actually. So we had some 8-track tapes lying around, and I was playing with the machine, putting them in and out. And I put one in, and it was the Bay City Rollers, which was kind of like a Detroit version of the Monkees.
Oh,
Think
okay.
that. And they had this hit from like the 1970s called Saturday Night. And I put it in, and the song, I mean, it was like their biggest hit. I think they even might have had a TV show out of it. This is years after they were popular. But I was like, wow, it just blew me away. And looking back, I think what hit me was the song had a hook. And I was like, and the hook grabbed me. And so that was re really the first, my first. The first musical thing I remember. And then I started popping in the other 8-track tapes after that. And my parents had Willie and Waylon, and I listened to that one a lot. And I think there was a Led Zeppelin 4 sitting in there, and some Beatles and some Bob Dylan and things like that. But my very first memory, again, as I'm embarrassed to say, is the Bay City Rollers.
Well, I wouldn't kick yourself too hard, but I think that's a really interesting story. It's funny how the type of tapes that you guys had around the house, some pretty good stuff there, but not a lot of music was played around the house in general, huh? While your parents were painting or anything like that.
No, they, because they weren't like really like super bohemian. It was really like a trip. My dad was an executive in New York City, and it was kind of like Wallace Stevens. He like worked really hard as an executive during the day, and then he'd be like painting at night and on the weekends. And my mom, painted full time, but it wasn't like a super kind of like granola household. It was actually kind of like a buttoned up, almost kind of conservative thing. And it was really weird. Like, my parents put a lot of money into our arts education, and they were really cool. We had long hair and our ears were pierced or whatever, but there were two things my mom didn't allow us to do, and that was we weren't allowed to swear, or we'd get a tablespoon of Tabasco sauce. And we weren't allowed to have girls in the house, because that, was all boys. Of course, we're, sneaking them in through the roof and that. But that was like, it was kind of that thing. So, it was like, in some ways it was like super bohemian, but in some ways there were like these definite, like, sort of Irish Catholic rule set that we had to follow.
Yeah, definitely. I wonder how much of the music kind of influenced, as far as like, oh,
Yeah.
whatever you say, mom and dad. All right, bring them
Yeah, it's a lot of that, a lot of that for sure. Yeah.
Oh, man. So going from there, when was the point in time where you wanted to kind of try music for yourself or learn an instrument?
So I think in third grade, right, as they do in elementary schools, right, they usually sort of like, at least in a lot of elementary schools, they like track you into an instrument at some point, right? There's some amount of music they throw at you. And my first instrument was violin, and I had violin for about a year, but I had a really hard time reading music, partially because I think I'm just a little bit dyslexic, and also probably because I wasn't quite practicing enough as I should have been. And at the end of a year of violin, I was like, I'm done. I can't deal with. So then threw a saxophone at me, right? I thought, oh, saxophone would be cool. And it was kind of like the same thing. Plus I had this music teacher, it was a little bit, it was kind of like, what's that, what's a what's that movie about that university music teacher? And say, and it's the guy from Law and Order plays the professor, and it's like, I don't know if it's a Juilliard Whiplash or something
Oh,
like that, right?
Whiplash,
Yeah,
yeah. It's one of my favorites.
yeah, what a, is what he's kind of a little bit like that
Oh,
Whiplash
wow.
guy, not quite that bad, so that really turned me off, and I got rid of that. And but my brother started playing guitar, my older brother, and I was motivated by my older brother's, almost 10 years older than me. And I was like, oh, this is really cool, and he had records, you know what I mean? He was listening to the Rolling Stones and the Grateful Dead and all this stuff. And I somewhere along the line, I learned that playing guitar was cool, and that like, if you play a guitar, like, you could also chase skirts, you know what I mean? And that was like, that was pretty much, sort of how that went. And once I picked up a guitar and, you know, I was playing like Beatles songs and Bob Dylan songs and things like that, you know, these kind of folk and rock and roll things, like I never looked back and I really dug it. And, you know, for a long time, you know, it was just the thing I, first thing I thought about in the morning when I woke up and the last thing I thought about when I went to bed. I mean, I was really obsessed as being a guitar player.
Did the guitar, the learning the guitar, did that come easy for you? Because I know you talked about the other, your other experience with your other instruments. How did it come for guitar for you?
You know, I think it came more easily for me because there wasn't so much emphasis on traditional, you know, sight reading, chord melody, all these type of things, right? So when I was, you know, young and learning how to play, you know, play my nylon string guitar, you know, I'd go take these guitar lessons and say, oh, I want to learn this song, and I'd learn that song, you know, or I'd want to learn, you know, this other song, and the guitar teacher would teach me this other song. So what I did, and I'm thankful for, was instead of getting into the mechanics, learned how to play things first before I got into the mechanics.
Okay. Nice. And then as far as like you know, a lot of obviously when it comes to like as you're learning guitar, you kind of find these icons that you're like, oh man, you know, I want to reach this status or this is the motivator for me to
Yeah.
pick up the instrument every day. Who were some of those artists for you when you were learning?
You know, when all I really cared about was playing guitar, you know, I think I was listening to, you know, a lot of cats like, you know, Eddie Van Halen, and I was listening to, you know, a lot of progressive rock. I was listening to like Yes albums and Rush albums, you know, and so all of those type of people were a big influence. And I think I remember being really into, you know, Steve Vai and you know, these sort of really like shredding guitar players. And for a long time, that was what I was really into. But the thing is, like, I'm not a good enough guitar player to be one of those people, you know what I mean? Like, I think I must have, you know, I must have sat at the foot of so many of them. You know, I remember I got like a private lesson like from Vinnie Vincent from Kiss, you know what I mean? And man, that guy could just, you know, shred like nobody's business. And there were a lot of those moments I had. But somewhere along the line, I realized, hey, I really like this, but that's not where my strength is. My strength is really as a songwriter, you know what I mean? So somewhere along the line, that switched. I'm still really into guitar players, and I identify as a guitar player, which is really bizarre. So like, you know, like in Nashville, like the thing to write a song is like to sit down with a piece of paper, and you get like these brilliant songwriters, and they'll like write the lyrics down, you know, and they'll have a song, and then like it seems to me like the music's like an afterthought, right? We got like a really great story. I can't write a song really without a guitar in my hands. So really a guitar is like an extension of who I am. So even though like, you know, I'm not a great guitar player, I still identify as a guitar player and a singer and a songwriter, and those things sort of all come together.
I commend you for continuing on because a lot of guitar, I feel like a lot of people that when they learn guitar, they play guitar and then they kind of idolize these folks that, you know, that you mentioned. And like you said, you know, you mentioned some of the most technical guitar players, you know, of our time. And definitely, I feel like there's always a point of there's a point of contention where you're like, okay, this it's not just that like I appreciate this artist or whatnot, but I'm a little intimidated because I don't know if I can have that particular skill. I've definitely had that particular notion as well, but a lot of artists, they just tend to, or a lot of people that learn guitar, they just put it down and they just don't. But I think it's interesting that you're like, well, you know what, this is, I feel like this is more of my strong suit. You know, obviously I'll continue to play guitar, but let me lean into this. You know what I mean? I think that's a good mindset because I can see a lot of people being discouraged and say, oh, fuck it. It's with a guitar
Yeah.
in the wall.
And that, you know, that turned me on to a whole bunch of other cats. You know, like I started listening, you know, I was like listening to Rolling Stones records going, oh man, Keith Richards is really fucking badass, you know. And I was listening to like Neil Young thinking, man, listen to that tone on Rust Never Sleeps, like holy shit. And he's into like banging on it like I'm into banging on it, you know, or like, you know, Willie Nelson, who's a tremendous guitar player, but like, you know, it's all like part of a package. So, you know, when I got away from like, you know, all these technical guitar players and started listening to what I think are more musical guitar players, I started identifying with like where my place is as a guitar player and as a musician.
Right, right. That's great. That's really great. Now, I know you mentioned, of course, songwriting, you know, as far as for who are some songwriters that, you know, influenced you to start writing and, you know, improve writing and all that stuff?
You know, I think like the stuff I grew up on, you know, listening to the Rolling Stones and the Beatles and Bob Dylan and, you know, Joni Mitchell and Joan Baez, you know, so like when I went to school, when I was in elementary school, we had this music teacher at like this big sort of like Guild jumbo guitar. And she used to like, you know, she was like this hippie and she used to like lead these like, you know, our music classes and, you know, the songs we would learn were like Simon and Garfunkel, right? And Bob Dylan and all this stuff. And those were the songs that we'd sing. So I think early on, even though like, I didn't know, like, you know, I wasn't pursuing it at the time, you know, I was like, I got to be able to like, you know, tap with 10 fingers or something like that. Those are the things where I really learned, you know, listening to that, like what a song was, what a story was. And then, you know, as I got, you know, got older, you know, even like when I was listening to like, you know, a lot of Pink Floyd and, you know, Rush and Yes, and, you know, all this progressive stuff. And then, you know, all the Neil Young stuff and the Rolling Stones and all that, the stuff I gravitated toward was the stuff that had better songwriting. You know? Like I remember like my brother was, you know, he's like almost 10 years older than me. He was really into the Grateful Dead. And like, you know, I'd listen to the Grateful Dead and I'd be like, man, there's not a song in here. Sorry. I'm not feeling it. You know, I'd be like, hey man, play Truckin'. Like that's a fucking song. And my brother would be like, ah, oh, man, that's bullshit. You got to listen to Space. I'm like, man, fuck Space. Like, you know, I'm like, so from a very early time, you know, I always gravitated toward that. And, you know, when I was listening, like, I remember like, you know, listening to Jane's Addiction and going, man, like Perry Farrell could write songs, you know, and like Nirvana going, fuck, these guys can write songs, you know? So I don't really like, I think that switch was really flipped when I first heard that Bay City Rollers song, you know, Saturday Night, you know, and then along the way, my ear just gravitated toward, you know, good songwriting, good storytelling. And hey man, it's gotta have a hook.
Yeah.
You know? And I think, you know, even listen to like a lot of the Nashville stuff, you know, a lot of the Willie Nelson, or the old Nashville, you know, a lot of the Waylon Jennings, all that type of stuff, you know, and, you know, Billy Joe Shaver even, right? That stuff, it's good stories, but there's a hook in most of those songs.
Right. Yeah, I'm starting to, it's funny, I've kind of had this musical journey myself, just kind of really unpacking the power of a hook, you know what I mean, and writing that, and I'm working on a project with a producer from Baltimore, and we were having a conversation the other day, and he was like, yeah, that hook you wrote, it's like, I just kind of had that in my head as I was traveling and like going to, you know, visit my mom and all this stuff, and I was like, oh, wow, I'm glad, at least that shows that the music's working, you know, whatever it is working, you know, it's just such a very, and I think it's interesting too for your story as far as how, you know, just that hook from listening to that tape, you know, just cascade along to your songwriting and writing hooks. What do you find yourself writing music about? What inspires you to write?
So yeah, like this is sort of like a long journey. So I guess to get into that. So you know, I played like every hour, every day from the time I was 10 years old until I was like 30, right? And you know, I had some you know, record deals that went south and all this type of thing. And then one day I just like, I stopped, you know what I mean? I was like, yeah, I'm done. I had, you know, I was tired of it, you know, not bitter, but I was tired of it. And I felt like I needed to make some money. I had a kid on the way, right? You know, nothing makes you want to like go make money more than the kid, but mostly I was just tired of it. And I was like, I'm going to go do something else. So I sold all my shit. You know, I kept the flat top guitar and I just sold all my shit. And, Yeah, a couple of things I regret selling now.
Right. As we all do. We're all like, damn.
So then I went to grad school and got a master's degree in computer science and went into tech, right? And I was in like tech for like, 10 years, and I wasn't even like thinking about music. And I got, I started getting, this call from a friend of mine who was like, hey man, I have like this honky tonk jam and you got to like come down and check it out. I'm like, man, piss off. I don't do that shit. I'm not interested. Right.
Yeah.
And I'm back to my thing. Right. And, every like couple of weeks he'd sort of needle me to show up. I'm like, I don't even have no shit anymore. You know what I mean? Like it's all sold. Okay. This conversation kind of went on and I kept pushing him off. And then one day I had a really bad day at work. You know what I mean? And he was like, come on, man, you got to come check this out. I said, all right, I'll come down, but you got to buy me some whiskey because I had a really fucked up day. Okay. So like, as long as you're getting me drunk, I'll come down and hang out. And so I go down and, drink some whiskey and this leads to that. He gets me up on stage and play a tune. And I'm like, wow, like what have I been missing? And this must be like, if I were a heroin addict or something like that and I relapsed or something.
Right.
So I was like, shit. So then I just kept like, I would like show up to jam session every once in a while. You know what I mean? And then this led to that. And then all of a sudden, I'm like, I got a honky tonk cover band. And I'm like, okay, that's cool. If I can get these guys out once a month and we can just get on the gas a little bit and play old honky tonk tunes, that's cool. And then, like, unfortunately, to your writing question, all of a sudden, like, I started writing songs again. I remember writing the first or second song I'd written in years, and I was like, oh, fuck, man, this is bad news, because, like, I know where this goes.
Right.
And so, and I just had this band, and it was cool. And then, like, the pandemic came along, and, not a whole lot was happening, so I just started writing, like, a bunch of tunes, and those were like, very sort of dark pandemic, almost biblical revelation influenced numbers, black and
right.
white, good and evil, these type of things. And yeah. we released an album like right after the pandemic, right? And it was kind of like called Blood on the Door. And it was an all right record. It was like, it was just, because I wasn't even thinking about a record. And then that's how I met, I ran into Derek. I'd played with Derek, who produced this record, back 15 years ago in this band. And, I ran into him and goes, I really love your shit. Let's make a record. I'm like, I don't want to hear anything about a record. So we made a record and, that stuff. So that songwriting, that was really, sort of inspired by the pandemic, and I guess that sort of like that sort of these binary opposites, right, that a lot of the themes of my stuff have probably are somewhat inspired by my Catholic upbringing, right? And also like there's sort of like, also aligns with like my nerdy computer side, right? Because everything's binary in computers, right? So I'm inspired by less by gray areas than I am by certainty on both sides and how those things play off of each other. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
And I really try to get to the heart of the friction between opposites, right? That's really, I think, what inspires me. Almost like, and I guess, some of it, certainly on that, on the pandemic stuff, almost like, kind of this dark Nick Cave type of thing, right?
Yeah.
And then this new album, which has similar themes, of opposites, love and loss and damnation and salvation and fornication and all these type of things. Those play into sort of like, what I was really doing was sort of revisiting my misspent youth. Which I've long tried to sort of escape from, but I realize, I guess, that I got enough bark on me to be able to look at that. And so this latest album, the second album, this band, the Midnight Desert Talk Radio, is sort of in reference to my misspent youth and, the amount of time I spent, smoking cigarettes like it was my job, probably smoking weed like it was my job, and listening to Art Bell, who is like one of those UFO conspiracy theory guys on the radio all night long. And so those are like the inspirations. I don't know. That was kind of wandering, but that did that sort of like, get.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like, as far as like when it comes to just experiences, and then as far as how you think about, as far as for those gray areas, and kind of converting that into like your lyricism, and your experiences. I think that's really interesting. As far as for the process of Midnight Desert Talk Radio, I mean, tell me as far as like how that process was working on that album. Was it like how many days did it take to record everything?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, it was probably pretty fast to record. So the way it sort of all began is like I generally just write all the stuff, and then I bring it in the studio and we practice it and we flesh it out and record it. I think the recording was probably, maybe 2 weeks. Not 2 weeks, sequentially, but it was probably 2 weeks of recording sessions and then probably another, week of overdubs, maybe another, 10 days of mixing and 4 or 5 days of mastering is probably how it went.
Okay. Nice. And then as far as like the players chosen, was it one of those things where the guy that worked with you on producing the album, that he knew a guy that knew a guy? Or as far as for the tell me about like the players that worked on the album.
Yeah, so I'm really fortunate to have this crew, so the 9 Pound Hammers. They are, a lot of them I've been playing with. We're playing like in this cover band I had initially. So the producer Derek O'Brien, who's also currently the drummer now, he was not the drummer on the first record, but he's got the drum chair now, and I've known him for many years, and sort of he just sort of fit in. When we decided it was time to switch directions for the drum throne. Leela Simon, who's the bass player, I've been playing with her for probably 8 years.
Oh, wow.
And so she's just somebody I've known and we played a bunch together. Philip Smith, the guitar player, who's like this really sort of magnificent sort of Danny Gatton, Marty Stewart, sort of amalgamation B bending player, also played in that sort of like cover band I had. And then the same thing with Ilya Portnov, the harmonica player. He was also playing in that band. And unfortunately, he popped off and moved to Nashville because we're based in Southern California and in LA, Santa Monica area. And so that's sort of like the core people I've been working with for a long time. And
Wow.
then we had a couple of people who were on the recording who aren't really in the band, like Kerry Frank is the B3 player and he plays for Social Distortion. And then a couple other people that we had as vocalists, Molly Greenspan, who's like an LA session vocalist, and they came in and added tracks where we needed them. And so that's basically like the crew that I had. So it's really like a crew of, really like four people and me, right? And people that I've played on and off with for years. And I'm just really fortunate to have them because they're just tremendous players. And the fact that that they're all working a lot, that we can get everybody in the same room at the same time and do what we do is just really awesome.
Definitely. Yeah, one of the things I was gonna say was, listening to a lot of those songs, there's definitely like a synchronization, or just as far as like this real progressive energy, and always, you can tell the band, you can tell how a band operates based on like its rhythm section. So like hearing the drums and the bass, and you're doing your lyrics and stuff, there's definitely like a real powerful energy. It sounds like you guys have been playing for a long time. I feel like you can always feel that energy. You know what I mean? So there's definitely a real like, there's a nuance of just like, this is like worn in, like type of like a science as far as working with these players. So it definitely has that vibe.
And
Were there? Oh, go
they're
ahead.
all kind of different too, right? Like, I mean, Derek's like an LA punk rock staple, right? So he was in Social Distortion Distortion, The Adolescents, and Agent Orange. And, you know, so he's like a very like Orange County punk guy. And then Philip, the guitar player, is from Oklahoma City, you know, and so like when he plays it, like it sounds like the Red Dirt, you know. I mean, it sounds like it comes from Tornado Alley, and Leela's from Colorado, you know, and it's very like this kind of like, you know, keep the rad in Colorado, you know, Rocky Mountain bass playing. And I think that that's one of like the great things about it. Ilya, who's off in Nashville now, sadly, is originally from Moscow, you know, so he's like a super technical, like the level of perfection in his playing, right? Like is just is it's like it has like almost a Bolshoi level of perfection. And so like that's what I think is also cool, is like, you know, all of these people from different parts of the world coming together to make this sound.
Any songs in particular on the album that kind of just that you remember more than most, as far as like the experience writing it or working on it?
You know, I don't, that's a really good question. You know, one of the things about like you know, which I think you probably understand with any album, right, is that by the time you're done with it, right, you've like heard it so many million times. You know, what I would say is that I think that there are a couple of songs on here that turned out to be really good, that were the hardest songs. Like when I came in, I was like, here are some really good songs, here are some average songs, and here are some songs that I don't even think we have a song yet. And two of those, I think, became like some of the best songs on the record. Like the Midnight Desert Talk Radio, I think, was like tough to get a song out of originally. And now, like, that's the title cut. And then Family Man, which we kind of brand as like a style of music we invented, we call murder disco. That was also, you know, was the least fleshed out. Probably two of the songs where I had like the least inspiration, and ended up like being the ones where we stretched and sort of pushed and pushed and pushed into places outside of my comfort zone. And I think they really sort of came together.
Places that were wrong, but I reckon that's better than nowhere at all. I worked the 99 in the middle of the night with them Freightliners whine.
Awesome, awesome. Wow. So as far as for just kind of closing up here a bit, I mean, so it's coming out November 4th, so around the corner. You know, which is very cool, and it seems like you're gonna be, your tour is kind of, seems like it's throughout Southern California, right?
We're focusing locally on this. You know, there is some talk of doing some dates in Nashville and a couple down in Florida, and we'll see how that goes. But we're really sort of focusing on growing this thing, really just like in the broader Southern California area, you know, so LA County, San Diego County, the Inland Empire, you know, Ventura County, Santa Barbara County, stuff like that. And really just trying to get that to happen. And we'll see where it goes from there.
Nice. One of the last questions I wanted to ask you, did you ever get the chance to buy back some of that stuff you missed when you sold it?
No, you know, I bet there's one. I don't know how much you're into, like, you know, guitar amps, but there's one guitar amp I had. So when I was playing professionally for years, I played Matchless C30s, which were like these amps from like the 1990s, and they were hand wired. And I'm not like a big boutique amp guy. Like most of the time, I'm disappointed by boutique guitar amps. These things were just the most fucking screaming, and sound men hated them, right? Because they were just so fucking loud, but they sounded so good. And now, like, to get one of those, like, you know, used, they're like $4,500. And I'm like, yeah, I'm not spending $4,500 on an amp, but I do think I know the guy who I sold them to. And I think, like, he doesn't, like we're friends on social media and I've seen him before. And I think we've even been jam sessions together. But I think looking back, I'm like, shit, I think that's the guy I sold those amps to. And I've seen him in pictures, like, you know, on social media with those two amps sitting in the corner. And I'm like, shit, I should go ask if he wants to sell those. But that's like absolutely like the piece of gear that got away. And then there's like so much other stuff that like I got rid of that, you know, I'm glad to have gotten rid of. Like, you know, it's a funny thing. People kill for all this vintage stuff. And like every vintage guitar I've ever had, I've gotten rid of because like I don't usually dig it. As a matter of fact, like I've got a vintage Gibson Trini Lopez, right? That's the guitar that Dave Grohl plays,
Oh, wow.
right? And it's from 1967, so it's like an ES335 with like a almost like a Fender Stratocaster looking headstock on it. And you know, I play this guitar and I'm like, man, I'm just not feeling it. You know, I use it to record with sometimes, but like, and I know people are just like, oh, that guitar. I'm like, I don't really get it. You know, and someone gave it to me as a gift, so like, I don't really feel like I could sell it. You know what I mean? I hang on to it. And but it's just like one of those things. Whereas like, you know, the guitars I do play, really I just play two guitars. Like my main guitars are I got a Fender Telecaster that I love, and I got a Collings, you know, flat top acoustic, and those are my two main guitars, and I just don't feel like I need anything more than that. So but that, yeah, that mat, those matchless amps, those are the one piece of gear that like if I could get them back I would. But like, you know, I you know, it's like I'm not gonna buy a Dumble, you know what I mean? It's you know, it's one of those deals.
Well, you know, I think definitely when you get to a point where you're like, I think this is fine. Like, I feel like that's kind of like the full circle as far as like when it comes to guitar purchasing. 'Cause I wish I was at that point, but I keep fucking finding guitars that I play and I'm like, God damn it, I
You know,
want
I stay out of music stores. Like I don't go into them. You know what I mean? For that reason. So like that's one of the ways I get away from it. What I've really sort of decided now is like with what I've got, I can get killer tone. And to me, tone is like the most important thing.
Oh, me too. Same.
You know, and if I've got and because like I'm a band leader, you know, like I sing and I play guitar, you know, like I'm kind of a one trick pony anyway. Like, you know, I need like two good tones on stage. Maybe three, but if there's more than that, like if I got to look down too many buttons to push, it's going to go side. You know, the whole thing will go tits up. You know, nobody wants that. So, like, really, I need like a good dirty tone, a really good clean tone, and then something that's got like a slap back on it. You know, and if those tones are great, I'm totally cool, and I'm making those tones as good as they can be. Whereas, you know, like, you know. If I were like the lead guitar player in the band, you know, then I'd have like 50 tones, you know, and like, you know, all this kind of stuff. But thankfully, like all I need are just like a couple of really good tones. And those are hard to get. You know, like I go back to albums and I'm like, man, like, how did Neil Young, like, how does he get that fucking tone? And how's Keith Richards get that tone? Like, I've been listening to like a lot of Clarence Gatemouth Brown lately, and I'm like, man, like, how does that guy play like that? And how does he get that tone? And so, like, that's really like my search now is how do I just get the best tone I can get? And I find like that's almost like it's like, you know, your reach exceeds your grasp on that. At least mine does.
Absolutely. No, I mean, definitely I've had, I'm definitely kind of a tone nut too, you know, like I have a Roland JC40 and I just, you know, I put my pedals together like they're the amp and they're just hitting the, you know, hitting a clean amp, you know, and I get a lot of compliments for like, man, your tone's crazy, you know. It's just like it's something that scouring over the internet, it's like I want this tone, I need this, you know, because I feel like it's an extension of me. It's like I want to sound this way, you know what I mean? So it's like a weird representation of yourself, you
I
know,
play
so.
there, and that's like the Jay Masses thing, right? Is like clean amp with like a really bland, almost like dull sound, low volume pedals, and that gives you like all this dynamic. And of course, he's like in, you know, like the top 50 greatest guitar tones of all time and guitar player, right? So I think you're probably on the right track there, because man, that guy's guitar tone is just insane.
Yeah. Crazy stuff there. Well, Andrew Browning, it's been a real pleasure talking with you, man. Congratulations on this album that's coming out real soon. I think a lot of people are going to dig it, man. So thank you for being on the show.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Of course, my pleasure. Well, there you have it, folks. This is Jarrell Powell here on the 440 Guitar Podcast. We'll jam again soon, and have a good day.